Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Janet Fitch is a smart, popular, award-winning author whose books include White Oleander and Paint It Black, both of which were bestsellers and both became movies. Her new book, Chimes of a Lost Cathedral, is the follow-up to her historical fiction from 2017, The Revolution of Marina M. Janet will be in Sacramento this Friday, July 26th, for an event with Stories on Stage Sacramento and the community of writers at Squaw Valley. She and I talked about the character of Marina and these two books recently in Squaw Valley.
Well, Marina is pregnant by her great true love, who was a very difficult guy. She's broken up with him in a passion, and she sought her family's estate, which is back in the country. She goes there and discovers that her mother set up a cult there, and she's going to try to wait out her pregnancy there, but it proves absolutely intolerable. And so at the end of book one, we've have her pregnant and leaving in the dead of winter to go anywhere else, somewhere else. And she's completely on her own for the first time in her life.
We are in the year 1919 in this new book. What is 1919 in Russia?
1919 is at the height of the Russian Civil War, the battle between the Reds, the Bolshevik forces, and the Whites, which were everybody who was not Bolshevik. Red Russia was shrunk to just the Central European part of Russia, with armies on all sides. Everybody was taking sides, and food scarcity was tremendous. Everything was in the balance.
Marina is married, but she's pregnant by someone else, her true love. She moves from harrowing and dangerous adventure to another worse, more frightening adventure. In there is the story of the birth of her baby. Will you talk about all that she endures in the context of the way she was raised?
Well, she grew up a daughter of the intelligentsia. Her father was a lawyer. Her mother was an artistic type of person. They were very well off, part of the Petersburg society. So she grew up with a nanny and a governess and maid and cook and the whole bit, but fell in love with a radical poet just as the revolution was breaking. And it was like stepping off one ice floe onto another, and she joined the life of the times. It was a coming of age, you know, as she's trying to figure out where she stands. I like characters who straddle worlds, who see both sides of things, a very kind of a stereoscopic view of events, and feeling the pull of the present against what she was raised with really raises her awareness of the changes. And by the time book two starts, she's already gone through that process. She has come of age. Now she's a woman. She has no one to depend on. No one is advising her. She is just taking her own measure of things. And it's a very difficult time. Luckily, she's a very passionate, courageous, adventurous person. And she is determined that she's going to survive and flourish and find herself and find her voice as an intellectual and as a poet and really, have something to say about life in those times.
You mix real-life characters with fictional characters, and you're a student of Russian history as well. So how did this story come to you?
My love of Russia came through Russian literature. So I saw her as a poet coming into herself. I didn't realize it was going to be about the revolution. I had the character, but I had her in the 20s living in Los Angeles, kind of the aftermath of the revolution. And every time I did the backstory, my writer's group was like, oh, no, that's the story we want to know. I majored in history. Russian history was my background. I wasn't unfamiliar with the time. And I thought, well, let's just do it. I have a motto. Dorothy Allison said that fiction never exceeds the writer's courage. And there are times that I really wondered, was I completely out of my mind doing this? maybe I'm out of my mind, but I've come too far and I'm not going to fall off the horse just because I'm afraid.
How many years?
12 for the two books.
There's no shortcut through a revolution, is there?
No. We're living in revolutionary times now.
Right.
I read a lot of memoirs in researching this book, and people were saying that every week was like a month. Every month was like a year. Their heads spun with how fast everything changed. So that's definitely a part of the book. But until these times, I had never experienced that myself. So as I was finishing the book, I'm like, oh my God, now I see what they were talking about.
There is a point, I would say three-fourths of the way through the book, when Marina's been through so much, and the whole cast of characters, which you lay out at the beginning, thankfully, have all endured and changed. And there's some reference to it being almost 4 years now. And I thought, wait, what? This feels like two decades that these people have struggled and suffered. And I found myself, Janet, strange as it sounds, feeling very appreciative for bread, a bed, for a warm bath. That if you really get immersed in it, I think you take stock of where you are and what you have yourself.
I feel like I've lived through the revolution. Having lived through this revolution longer than the revolution took, you know, 12 years, I don't take the word lightly anymore. You know, what we're going through is a seizure, but revolution is something quite different. And especially the people who start a revolution are not necessarily the people who finish it. Things change a lot as it goes along, and people who end up with power are not necessarily the idealists who start things. It made me much more appreciative of the muddle through thing that democracy is, the imperfect, messy, overly talkative. Some people think revolution is just going to sweep everything clean and we can start again. But it's not like that. It's an apocalypse. I mean, it's a huge and unpredictable thing. And it made me appreciative of our democracy.
You are listening to Janet Fitch. Her best-selling books include White Oleander, Paint It Black. Both were made into movies. We are talking about the sequel to The Revolution of Marina M. The new book is titled Chimes of a Lost Cathedral. It seems like this book still has a grip on you. We are in 2019. The revolution was 1919. But how much is your head or some version of your whole sensory self still in it?
I'm slowly, slowly climbing out. I put an app on my phone, you know. I'm still signing checks 1919.
Wait, putting an app on your phone is a sign that you are in present day.
Well, I'm trying to move back into, you know, our current moment. But yeah, I'm still very much in 1917, 1919, 1921.
Are you done with Marina for a while?
For a while, absolutely. You know, never say never. I don't know if I'll ever
get back there.
I would like to write in the present for a while, but, you know, she still has some tricks up her sleeve.
We are having this conversation in Squaw Valley, and in fact, we are in a home that for a while was a bit of a base for you while you were writing this book.
Yeah, it's high up in the Sierra at the home of Barbara and Oakley Hall, who were the founders of the Squaw Valley Community of Writers, and their daughter, Brett Hall Jones, is one of the administrators of the program. And she invited me to come and stay in her parents' house to work on this book because it was a massive project. And I came, it was early May, there was still snow everywhere, with my milk crates full of books. I mean, I traveled at the time with 30 reference books and then these giant ring binders, 7 ring binders that contained the novel. Work and stoke the stove. Oakley was a writer, and the place is full of signed first editions. And I felt so embraced by literature and by the mountains. Felt like I could be in Russia here. You know, in LA, it's very hard to be in 1919 Russia.
Would you read a passage that you would have worked on when you were up here in the Olympic Valley?
Yes, yeah, I got a chance to be really cold. So this is a chapter that begins, the temperature dropped down into the sarcophagus of negative numbers. minus 30, minus 40, minus 50 degrees. On Shpilernaya Street, all the tenants dragged their mattresses into the front parlor, where we slept pressed together for warmth, pooling our wood, breathing each other's breaths, sharing each other's lice. When the wood was gone, we tore up the floorboards at the back of the apartment. A dying city eats itself alive, the way a starving body consumes its own flesh. Every day people died in the street, just dropped as they walked along or fell in the queues. Nothing could be done.
Janet Fitch, reading from Chimes from a Lost Cathedral. You did say that you carry binders along with you, not that you were writing this on a laptop?
I write on a laptop, but I always print out. I've certainly had computers die on me. I want to see it on the page. I don't like the ephemerality of writing on a computer. I mean, I have terrible handwriting. I'm very grateful that there is such a thing as word processing, but I want to see the chapters. I want to see the alternation of day and night, interior and exterior, very introverted scenes with groups of people. And I can sense that much more clearly when they're in ring binders, how big scenes are, how big chapters are.
How big books are, Janet? The first book was over 800 pages, and I didn't realize when I read it there would be a book two, but it so clearly left everything hanging that I thought there better be a book two. This one is almost 800 pages. When it came to you, was it one story or was it two parts of one story?
It was a continuous story. Now that I've been working on it, knowing that it was going to be published in two volumes, I really started to see how it did fall into two parts emotionally for the character. The coming-of-age story, The Revolution of Marina M., and then the story of a woman upon whom the blows have landed, and how do you form your life through that? How do you make moral decisions that are informed decisions, but very difficult ones? I felt that it was a kind of a different flavor, different color, as the second half of the revolution was very different than the first half. Much less about idealism and much more about power.
I love the second half of the story, the richness, the characters, the connection, so much movement, so much intensity that happened to everybody, and I felt really transported. What are you writing now?
Two short stories, one a noir crime story set in the desert in Palm
Springs.
You really
are shifting away from the
moment. And one a sci-fi.
Yeah.
An asteroid where they send the artists, get them off planet because they're troublemakers. And in Soviet Russia, there was a town called Peredelkino, which was a dacha town where a lot of the very famous writers lived. It was treated sort of as a privilege, which it was, but it was also they were too famous to kill. Pasternak, Akhmatova, these people lived at Peredelkino where they could keep an eye on them. They tormented their families, but they themselves were spared. Is it a prison or is it a writer's colony? That's a very interesting question. So I'm working on that, and I'm working on getting some ideas for a new book.
So ultimately, in all of the stories, even the new one you're just describing, I wonder whether you're trying to teach us or whether you're trying to make us wonder, to keep us curious and learning.
I don't think about that so much as just patches of conflict, of areas where I feel that on some deep level inside of me, where my obsessions and fascinations are, there are things that trouble me. What do you believe? What is the future? What is worth fighting for? What is not worth fighting for? What does it mean to be adult? What does it mean to have responsibilities and then also have challenges outside of those responsibilities? And how do they weigh against each other? I think that there's always the call of idealism and then against that, the practicalities of real life. And often idealism fails to take into account protecting those we love, being sensitive to kind of the tenor of real reality. The Bolsheviks were idealists, but people were sort of in the way. You know, they shove them around until they're in the right place or get rid of people, just, you know. Whereas Marina came to dislike the idea of looking at people from such a distance. You know, those are people's, these are our lives, you know. Does the end justify the means? That kind of question. These are the questions that I return to.
A PS to this is, what about writing poetry? These books have been full of a lot of poetry that I know to some degree has been translated from Russian original poetry and Russian books, but what about your own?
It's very funny. I find it much easier to write my characters' poetry than it is to write my poetry.
Wow.
Because I know where my characters are. I understand what they're thinking about, what is worrying them. I know what they've read, who they admire as poets. And so when I write their poetry, it speaks directly to what's going on with them. Hmm. For myself, you know, it's much more submerged. I don't know what's going on with me. I have written some poetry. I actually came up here to Squaw Valley when this book was done and gave myself a gift of the poetry week. I was a participant. It was fabulous. But it was much more difficult than writing my character's poetry.
So you need a character named Janet Fitch. And then you.
But who
poetry.
Is that? You know, our self, you know, the self is so evanescent. I could never write a memoir, for instance. I have absolutely no idea who I am. I'm a cloud of little charged particles and little experiences and little points of view. Just this cloud of information. It doesn't have a shape to it. I have no idea who Janet Fitch is.
That was Janet Fitch in a conversation recorded at the Hall House in Squaw Valley. She and I will continue the chat this Friday, July 26th, in a lovely evening of entertainment at Clara Auditorium. There is a link to more information on our website, capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.